Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Welcome back to Soul Sisters. I'm your host, Jessie Katz, and I know that you guys don't want to wait for this intro to be over. You want to hear us talk to Paula Cole. So I will let you do that in 1 second because this is an awesome episode with a kick-ass lady. Just want to mention, I would love to make sure that you guys are subscribed to the Soul Sisters podcast on iTunes. If you found this some other way, please head on over there and look us up and click subscribe so you don't miss any past or future episodes. If you enjoy this one, you will enjoy a lot of recent episodes we've been cranking out with some other really kick-ass ladies, including some other women that Paula played with at Lilith Fair. This is the 20th anniversary of Lilith Fair, which we got into with Paula. And we have a lot of her sisters already banked up in our episodes, so go check those out. Keep following us on iTunes. We're on Instagram, Soul Sisters Podcast. Check that out. Take a lot of goofy pictures with our guests, which I think you guys will enjoy. And don't forget that Soul Sisters is also now on YouTube. You can watch a lot of our episodes there on Billboard's YouTube channel. You can actually just watch us chatting in the studio with these awesome women. So go check us out everywhere that we exist. We are waiting for you to find us. All right. Without further ado, here is Paula Cole on Soul Sisters. Paula Cole, what's going on?
Hi.
Hi. How are you?
I'm great.
Good.
It's great to be in the city. Great to be here.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's right. You don't live in the city.
Not anymore.
Yeah. When did you live in the city?
A good chunk of my life I did. Like a lot through the 90s.
Yeah.
And my daughter went to preschool and kindergarten here.
Oh, did she? Okay.
Yeah.
So you have good memories of that time.
Oh, yeah. The majority of my adulthood was here.
Yeah. Where were you living? Were you in Manhattan?
Mostly Lower West, so Chelsea and West Village.
Nice.
So I feel like a displaced New Yorker.
Do you?
Yeah. Yeah. So you were part of the 90s scene.
I was in my 20s in the 90s in New York City. Yeah. It was explosive. It was wonderful.
Yeah.
Did you do like the Bitter End and
All
the clubs?
Yeah,
the
Bottom
scene?
Line, Bitter End. I mean, gosh. Cafe Chenet was a big one for me. That was in the East Village. That's where Jeff Buckley played a lot, and that's where I played a lot and got signed on St. Mark's Place between 1st and A.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Such a time, man.
Yeah.
You know?
I went to a taping of another radio show last night, and Janine Garofalo and Lily Taylor were the guests on it, and they were talking about the 90s a lot, and they were remembering the 90s as like a very innocent time looking back on it, which is funny because I don't think of it that way or remember it that way. Like, I feel like we were still dealing with a lot of shit that we're dealing with now.
It's so nice you're saying shit. That's so
Oh,
great.
Yeah, we can say, yeah, go for it. Let it fly. But, like, do you have nostalgia for that decade? I mean, because you were in your 20s, so I'm sure you have feelings of, like, oh, it was fun, and I, like, did a lot of cool things back then. But, sweeter time, you know?
I try not to wallow,
yeah.
You know?
Right.
And get mired in nostalgia. It was wonderful, though. I mean, it was the first time someone youngish was president with Clinton at that time.
That's right.
It was just definitely more democratic, and that felt like growth. There was huge growth in the economy.
Yeah.
As a recording artist, I visited a lot of the country. I was visiting mom and pop independent radio stations all around America when they still existed before they were so monopolized by, you know, one or two stations that they own, thousands of stations across America. If you think about it, there's like a mix station in every major city. There's a Kiss station in every major city. So before that telecommunications act happened, it was creative. And the internet, all that was building. So yeah, it was wonderful. The music scene was wonderful.
Yeah.
There was hope in the air.
Yeah. Okay, so creatively, maybe it was a more innocent time, especially. Just felt more hopeful.
I guess so. Than right now. Today. Right now. You're talking to me today.
Do you mean innocence? Like, what sense of innocence? Like, I guess.
I mean, I think they were talking about it in the sense of what was happening in the world.
Like, yeah. I mean.
You know? Which
I know. I'm very depressed by today, and I don't want to get mired down by that either.
No, let's not get mired.
I know. And today's a dark day in history. Like, you know, the Senate just voted to repeal the Affordable Care Act. So that's like so heavy on my heart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was just up in the Bronx. I was just seeing so many people struggling, and it's so hard to know what the outcome of all this will be. And it's so confusing. But and like, we have to stay bright. We have to keep our souls bright and hopeful and help people, because we are in a position to help people. We are in a position to be a voice. So I can't get too down by that, even though I'm incredibly sad and angry today. So today you're asking me. Today you're asking me of all days. But, you know, there's always tragedy and difficulty in every generation, right? I mean, if you were to ask boomers about the late 60s, they thought that was really, really horrible and hard. But look at the music. So we just have our share of today's stuff.
But I guess you're right in the sense that in the specific, like, 90s music sort of culture scene, there was a pocket of time where it felt pretty chill. A little, like, relative to...
Yeah, but I still felt like there was so much turmoil. I mean, you know, I was not terribly old in the 90s, but I remember there being a war, and I remember there being, like, a lot of political scandal, and things still felt very tumultuous.
Right.
You know? I mean, it's still... We're in a special time that is hard to compare in American history.
Right.
I'm not saying that we're not. Yeah.
Yeah. There always is.
Right.
There's always hardship. I guess one thing that's extraordinarily different is, like, we're all on phones. We're all media connected that way instantaneously. And also, like, half of the population of species are gone.
Mm-hmm.
So in my lifetime, like, I'm really aware of that, of animals around the planet. There's a lot of endangered species on the brink, and probably in my daughter's adulthood, they won't be there anymore. So
that's crazy.
Yeah, that I really feel for.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Like, sometimes I feel like I need to be Saint Francis of Assisi and drop it all, drop it all. Everything I'm doing and
drop
to help
music and like, because does this type of these emotions and these thoughts come out in music, or do you say music's not the vehicle to work with these?
I'm so
ideas?
Torn. Like, I could get really heavy on Twitter, and
really?
I don't, and I'm restraining myself with that fine line. Right? Mm-hmm. We all do. How much do you say?
Because it feels futile, or because it's makes you feel worse? Or why do you hold yourself back?
Because I think some people will stop listening. And it has to be about love.
Right.
You know, it has to be about light in order to reach more hearts and open more minds. So
it's so hard not to preach to the choir.
Yeah.
It's really hard. But I will say, we were talking a little bit before we started this, that we saw you do a show recently where you sang Joni Mitchell and John Lennon songs. And I remember thinking about that night that, first of all, Joni Mitchell songs are just so beautiful that will always bring joy and beauty to people's lives, which is always important, especially in a time like now. And John Lennon songs feel very timely, again, in a way that they haven't in a while, because things feel so tenuous and scary right now.
I know it.
You know? So I would hope that would bolster you when you have moments of feeling like, should I keep doing this, or is there any point to it, to just focus on that.
I go in the music, and
right.
Like you're talking about that show I did, and I had to learn these songs so well to replicate them, to play them. So I'm inside John Lennon's head learning his chords. His chords are so beautiful. I have such an appreciation for his harmony, his harmonic sense. His chords are so beautiful.
Yeah.
And Joni, I mean, so complicated. There'll be a bar of five and a bar of four, you know, and then a bar of two. And it's really lyrically dense. Her songs are difficult and open, all these strange tunings for the guitar player to learn. But I got inside their heads, and it helped me. It totally helped me. And absolutely, John Lennon's songs are really timely, really needed right now.
Yeah. What is your relationship with Joni Mitchell's music like throughout the course of your life? Because I have to say, to even attempt Joni Mitchell, you have to know that you can do it. Like, if you only meet that halfway, it's not going to come out well. Those are not easy. I mean, your band alone, for your band to play and your guitarist to play it that well, was like, wow, because that's not easy music.
And you want to bring your own flavor to it, which you did beautifully, but still honor that same sound that we all have in our heads and sort of strike that balance.
Yeah, and for you to sing it as you in your own beautiful way, but where you're not going like, but Joni's really good, because that's the challenge, right?
Doing all of the hits, doing all of like the one after the other is just like the crowd pleaser hits, and for it to be just winner after winner, it was really like extraordinary to see. And
So you nailed it. So I'm wondering, like, have you always listened to that music? Is it in your DNA? So it just kind of like poured out of you. I'm sure that you also worked a lot to prepare the show, but
I practiced. I had to learn a song. And there are certain songs that are deceptively simple, like John Lennon's song that's called Love. Uh-huh. Love is real, real is love, you know. And it's got this really simple little classical piano part. Mm-hmm. And it just needed to be played just the way he played it. So I had to shed, as they say. Yeah. I had to practice it. And
do you enjoy that process?
I did. It was kind of, hermetic, uh-huh. but it expands me as a writer and as a musician. So yeah, I loved it. And definitely music is in my DNA. I mean, my dad was a professional musician. Mm-hmm. So it's there. I came to the Beatles late because I lived in this little tiny town on the tip of an island in northern Massachusetts, and the FM signal didn't even, so this is way pre-internet, right? The FM signal didn't even get in properly, so I couldn't listen to the radio very well. So a lot of music was made in the house by my dad.
Oh, wow. And they didn't have any Beatles records lying around?
We didn't have any Beatles records.
Did you have records?
We had records. Actually, my dad was on records, so I could pull out his vinyl. And they had a couple of things. They had some Simon and Garfunkel, some Paul Simon. Uh-huh. They had Dolly Parton and Johnny Cash. They had Americana things.
Nice.
But I didn't start listening to the Beatles till college.
Okay.
I arrived really late. Wow.
Yeah. I wish I'd arrived late. I feel like I overdid it on the Beatles in my early childhood. Yeah, because my parents like really pushed it on me. And then I had a long break where I was like, I can't anymore. I can't hear them. Mm-hmm. And now I'm coming back to them.
Right.
But
I don't think there's any wrong time.
I hear that some kids, when they listen to the Beatles, when they grow up, they say, I thought the Beatles were writing for me as a kid, like Buffalo Bill.
Oh, sure. And,
you know,
Yellow Submarine.
That's right. Rocky Raccoon. And right? I mean, they sound like kids' songs.
Totally.
That guitar player at your show, we were starting to say that outside.
Right.
I mean, I know that you're a teacher now at Berkeley, your alma mater. Is that right?
That's right.
And so we were wondering, or maybe you said it. I can't remember if you said it or we were just guessing at the show. Because he looked so young.
Guessing.
If he was a student or if you ever take your students on the road and like just how...
About him and the drummer, I think we had the same question.
Yeah, they were so young.
If they were students of yours.
They are recent students, so they're grads. Okay. They're in their mid-20s.
Okay.
And Noe Soha, he's a guitar player from Italy. Uh-huh. And he's blind, and he's amazing. He's amazing, and I actually first heard him playing at Berkeley on Joni Mitchell songs.
Oh, really?
Right, and that's how we connected. We were both playing with this amazing drummer. Her name's Terry Lynn Carrington, and... she's won several Grammys. She's a beautiful jazz player. Uh-huh. We met with Terry Lynn, and I asked him. He plays with me periodically, and he's so fast. Like, if there were a hum in the room, he could tell you, oh, that's an A-flat, and he has perfect pitch, you know.
Uh-huh.
So I work with him periodically. He can play anything. And my drummer, Max, also is a recent grad, and I do enjoy millennials there's a few artists that come through. And it's just wonderful to connect. And age doesn't matter. We love the music, and we bond, and we make music together. So I guess we're just on the path together of music, right?
Yeah, that's beautiful.
It must be a nice way to not necessarily have to work on anything specific or be going towards a goal all the time, but you're immersed in music, you're teaching, you're with younger people, and sort of like the energy there. I went to the 5-week performance there.
Did you?
Yeah, and then I subsequently went to the New School for Jazz, which is a very different. I think at the time, at least, you know, it's like 10 years ago, the New School was very, you know, concerned about jazz being the focus. And it was the New School for Jazz and contemporary music, but it was really focused on jazz. And I know that Berklee had a much more wide-ranging, you know, you could explore more and the different genres are more prominent. And I imagine now it's even more so. And that, like, computer music is more kind of an option and things like that. And so I'm just curious, it must, like, your different emotions coming back to that school and teaching there when it's probably just a different animal at this point.
It's like the Death Star. It keeps absorbing planets. Like, it just absorbed Boston Conservatory. So now they offer BOCO at Berklee, and you can take dance and theater, and it's enormous and amazing. And actually, there's I've met another artist, Denny. She sings with me periodically. She's in her early 20s too. She was my student. It's wonderful to meet talent and see them go off and be artists. And that's what I hope for them, is that they think like an artist and start being an artist. There's everything there, though.
Yeah. I mean, do you find it harder to give advice and in terms of the music business because it's so
hard,
impossible,
brutal
and tricky
and
to...
Vastly different.
Yeah. And I don't know, you know, do you have a perspective on it when students come to you and say, like, you know, what should I do? Or, you know, just direction in general this kind of way.
Yeah. There really isn't enough of me to go around when I'm there. And then I go and I do concerts and I fly around the place and then I come back in and I teach, and I feel very needed, and that's wonderful. And you don't want to kill dreams. You never, ever want to do that. You want to nurture and give people guidance.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important that they write. I think it's important that singers write and own their intellectual property.
Mm-hmm.
And also just explore the depth of their psyche and put it out there, kind of write out their life. That's the style I'm in. That's the vein I love, like Joni and like John. They both wrote out their life. They were autobiographical writers. That's what I love.
Mm-hmm. So you are a jazz student, and then many of us discovered you as a pop star.
I know.
And now we're rediscovering you.
Oh, the lament on your face.
You can see my face, like, pop star. Oh,
I didn't know. I was just, pop star is also the key. Both
star.
Words are key words, but
yes. Yeah. But it seems like jazz is a through line, and now it's like really becoming prominent again. Yeah, and you have this beautiful new album where you're exploring it, and so I guess I probably can guess the answer to this, but why did it go from jazz to pop to then back to what you love the most?
That's a great question. And I think there's two main things.
Yeah.
One was that I didn't want to sing the realities written by Rodgers and Hammerstein or Rodgers and Hart anymore, especially as a woman.
Mm-hmm.
I can really celebrate that on your podcast.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Because they were written by, you know, a couple of guys in the 1940s or 50s. And some of the lyrics are just so antiquated, and I always struggled, like, oh, here comes this horrible bridge.
Right.
Or, you know, here's this song, He Beats Me, or
right.
And a man is born to go a-loving, a woman's born to weep and fret, to stay at home and tend her oven, and drown her past regrets in coffee and cigarettes. You know, these kinds of things.
No irony there.
Yeah, right.
Right.
No,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. No.
Or, you know, I enjoy being a girl. Do you know that one?
Yeah.
Holy shit.
The Flower Drum song?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Rodgers and Hammerstein, and I had to sing that song. You know, and every night I wanted to vomit, and I sang it, and it was, you know, cutesy.
Yeah.
When I hear the complimentary whistle, it's hysterical.
Yeah.
That greets my bikini by the sea. I turn and I glower and I bristle, but I'm happy to know the whistle's meant for me. You know, so it's silly, right? It's like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
I need to write my own realities, clearly.
You get to a certain age where you realize,
sounds
like,
good. It's not, the melody's nice.
Right. And it's fun. It's an amazing piece of music for that musical, but like, okay, what are my options here? So there's that. And then I was going through a lot of inner turbulence, and I needed to write. It just was like therapy. I guess, and I had another reason, but that the lyrics, the truth and the therapy of it.
Well, did it just happen when the songs you were writing, were they just sort of more poppy, and then when it developed, it sort of like took on that
it
form?
It was a hybrid, and actually a record company, when I was a senior and in college, they were jazz label. They wanted to sign me, and I didn't take the deal. People thought I was insane because I was rejecting a record deal when I was still in college, but I didn't want to be pigeonholed. I remember the other reason, sorry, is that I was so mean to myself in my own head, and I wanted to improvise what they call scatting, which I hate that term. It's also loaded. Scat, in like a biological sense, means feces.
Right.
Right?
And it's like, but is that related to the word scat in jazz?
It is, sounds like fucking feces. Shooby dooby scooby doo, you know, that kind of crap. So, but I love Chet Baker and I love Ella Fitzgerald. Yeah. And what was coming out of me, I thought did sound like scat, right? And okay. And I was so disappointed in myself.
So you can improvise, you can vocally improvise.
Right.
Which is scat,
I wanted to, yes.
But you weren't comfortable with that idea? Or
it's just that my bar was so high that it was impossible to attain. Mm-hmm. I
didn't think she sounded good enough.
I didn't think I sounded good enough.
It's very hard to sound.
So I left it. And it's taken me 50 years of life to realize, well, I'm not Chet Baker. Of course I'm not Chet Baker. And I'm not Ella Fitzgerald. Uh-huh. I'm me. And I'm with all my foibles and strengths, and I'll sing it like I sing it. And I'm entitled to that voice. And I've certainly sung on a whole bunch of other people's jazz albums and soundtracks.
Yeah.
So it was time to finally make my own.
Okay. So, but you're saying that the pop was naturally coming out of you at a certain point.
Yeah.
That wasn't because someone was pressuring you. Like,
no.
Can you try this sound? Because we could sell this sound.
No. In fact, it was the opposite.
Okay.
I was declining a jazz deal because I needed to write my own stuff.
Yeah.
And it didn't come out jazz, I thought. It was more pop.
Yeah.
Were you writing with someone, or did that just happen naturally through your own writing?
That was my own writing. That was me in my bedroom.
Yeah.
And like a therapy process, you know, writing about my feelings.
So that would have been Harbinger, your first record?
Some of that, yeah. Watch the Woman's Hands was one of the first songs I wrote. I was in college. I was working with a crappy four-track recorder, and I didn't have drums, so I just clapped, which became the backbone, and then I made that melody, Watch the Woman's Hands.
Would you layer it with your recorder?
Yeah.
Well, it's like pre-grad band making your own.
Yeah,
demos.
It was.
Yeah, it's like
in my bedroom.
Yeah.
So what do you think it was about? I'm so fascinated by like those two first records and how This Fire was the one that caught on and got you that Best New Artist Grammy, but was your second album. Was that like... Do you think your sound had evolved that much between the two? Or it was just one of those fluky things where people just all of a sudden paid attention?
I guess there was an upward rise.
Yeah.
And blips along the way. Sometimes something great would happen, then something bad would happen. Like
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Harbinger came out, and then the record company went bust, and you couldn't find it anywhere. And while I was out on tour with, I was opening for Melissa Etheridge on her Yes I Am tour. You couldn't get a better gig. Right? That was the pinnacle of her career. And I'm the opener for like a month. And my record company goes bust and you can't find it anywhere. So that took away the momentum. Mm. We were poised for a second single. It didn't happen. Uh-huh. But I ended up on Warner Brothers. And I think there was still a bubbling under of some zeitgeist. And then this fire came out. I just see them as snapshots, you know, of where I was at. And this fire was just more explosive. It was me rebelling against being the good girl I was trying hard to be for so much of my life, the straight A student I sing about and you know, in that song, Bethlehem on Harbinger. Harbinger is, I'm pretty turbulent with my feelings. It's highly produced. I self-produced on this fire. It was much more raw. I'm like primal screaming on it. Mm-hmm. And I'm just ripping away the image of the good girl that was confining me. It was like a snake skin I needed to shed and get rid of and kind of scream out of. I had anger. All women have anger. We don't get to express it constructively. Mm-hmm. And in music, I can express it and it doesn't hurt anybody and actually helps a lot of people because we can let it out there. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
When you look back on that time producing that record, are you amazed at how much you were able to do on your own, how much the label allowed you to do and that you were produced it on your own? You had never produced, you know, a record, a studio album before. I mean, and then you won the Grammy for Best Producer for that record.
I was nominated.
First woman ever nominated for producing her own record. And you were on Warner Brothers, this big record label that you'd think would give you a lot of, you know, just boundaries. What was the time like that you were making it? Like, how are they treating you? How did you feel?
Yeah, what a great question. And it was all about individuals. They were all men, of course. They're all men. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you'd feel like, oh, this is a patriarchal dinosaur. Like, you know, I have to like channel all my Zen energy right here. I'm going to be so loving. I'm going to be so full of light and I am going to fucking convert this moment, you know,
it's like me in every meeting I ever have.
And then there'd be someone who got it, some wonderful human being who happened to be male, who was supporting me. And so slowly, slowly gathering allies and just working really hard. I was so under budget. I was really a dark horse. It was difficult. And I had to come in really under budget and deliver that. But I learned a lot from my first album. I learned a lot from kind of producing a lot of my own demos anyway. So
I mean, you were a musician. Like, you went to school for it. You really studied the music, so you were able to say, you know what you want, be confident in that. I imagine that's key, is to say, like, I know what I want this to sound like, and I can express it, execute it.
Right.
All of those things.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm probably lacking on the high end of engineering vocabulary, but I've got enough. And the amazing thing is there are so many producers that don't have that anyway.
Right.
What is a producer? You know, it's so many things. But I was absolutely ready, and I've been doing it ever since. It's just natural for me.
That's something that I think women often do to ourselves, is question our qualifications in that way, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like, well, I haven't, like, really earned it or done it for long enough or, like, know all the little things. And then if you really think about it, mm-hmm. most people don't. And that's how you learn, is you just do it.
That's right.
So if you just empower yourself.
That's right.
Then you'll get all those things. Yeah.
Yeah.
Can we talk about the 20th anniversary of Lilith Fair for a second?
Oh, yeah, of course. Whatever you want.
This is basically the Lilith Fair podcast at this point. From the original lineup, we've had,
like, Suzanne Vega.
Five.
Oh, fabulous.
And you guys have been amazing. I've been seeing a lot of oral histories that you have participated in this past year, which is amazing because it's, like, so fun to read those. But I saw, I think it was an interview they were doing with Sarah McLachlan about it, and they were asking her about bringing it back. And she said people are always clamoring for it, especially now, because they think because of Trump and the Women's March that it would be an especially good time to do it. But she was saying that we don't need another Lilith Fair. We, like, it should be its own thing. new artists should do it, that it doesn't need to be a new iteration of the old thing, which I thought was so interesting. And I wondered how you felt about that.
That's an interesting question. I don't know how I feel about it.
Yeah. I mean, I would imagine it would be a lot of fun for you to get back together with a lot of those women that were also friends of yours, from what I understand.
Yeah, and still are. And
yeah.
Still. Well, it's interesting if it would be the lineup from then with added stars from, like, you know, the younger,
I think that would be the dream.
Yeah, that would be the total dream. I mean, when I was researching this and remembering, so we were, you know, teens during Lilith Fair, and just looking back at it now, I just am tempted to, like, read the names because it's so unbelievable it's that nuts. All of you guys were of this time and in one place performing that I can't imagine that really working today in the same way because of the, I guess, the different sounds and appeals that are.
Well, and so, also, there's like, still the notion, which you guys were talking about and everything I was reading was true back then, which is that you can't have more than one woman headlining, you know, at the same time.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Like, you, which is still true still today. Don't see that ever. Which is, still true. I was in a band. We changed our name to sound less so that a booker wouldn't necessarily know right away that we were female.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's still nuts. 20 years later, that's still a very real thing.
Yeah.
But imagine, like, Beyonce and Rihanna and Brittany Howard from Alabama Shakes, and you could go on and on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Rhiannon Giddens, and just keep going and going. Bring in all colors, all styles. That would be huge.
It'd be amazing.
Old, yeah, young. And that is something that could be improved upon from the original one. It's just, like, more women of color. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Although that's on accusation because I know, like, Sarah's talks about how she put out asks to a lot of people and you kind of, like, took whoever was down to do it. And
that's right.
Anyway.
It was an experiment first year. And Tracy Chapman was there, too. She was there.
Yeah.
Lauryn Hill was there a second year, I think.
And Erykah Badu was there.
Erykah Badu and Missy Elliott.
And Yari.
Yeah, like, it was nuts.
It gives me chills just to think about that lineup.
I know. And I was not aware at the time that it was that stellar.
I don't think so either.
I probably wasn't aware of all those artists at the time anyway. Like, I don't know that all the names meant something to me yet.
It was amazing. Yeah.
Anyway, it'd be cool if someone did something similar again. I'm saying we would like it.
Yes, we would love
it. Just putting it out there to the universe.
And the world needs it. There's such an underground energy right now rising.
Yeah. And I will say that, I mean, I remember feeling like it had a fringe sensibility to how it was discussed back then, you know? But it was, like, the highest grossing, what was it?
National touring festival
of that year, that first year. Just, like, knocked everything away. Yeah.
It was electric. It was fantastic. The audiences were fantastic. It felt like what Woodstock probably felt like originally was hope. I don't know. There might have been more women, but it certainly felt half and half to me from the stage. And everybody wanted a better world.
I was just going to say, I saw cool pictures of you performing from behind you.
Oh, yeah, the piano.
And seeing the crowd in front of you. And it was very mixed gender.
Yeah, very much. Yeah.
A lot of dudes were out there.
Totally.
Also, just like a huge crowd. Those pictures are very cool.
They're beautiful. I know.
That's
Mary Sear. She was a beautiful photographer.
Yeah, gorgeous.
We're in such a different time and sort of level of consciousness for feminism. I feel like in the mid-90s, it was almost like a taboo word. Yeah, it was a loaded word to say feminist. And so it was very much not considered, even though it was full of women, only women, you couldn't really talk about it in that context of it being like a feminist tour, which it wasn't. It was just women.
You have to be like, it's feminist.
I know.
Right, but
it was
now,
a dirty word.
Right, exactly. But I think if it were to happen today, there would be so much more pride specifically directed at the fact of it's happening, as opposed to like, look at all the like, just a different sense.
I know it. I love the millennials for that. They just have busted open that word.
Totally,
it's not loaded anymore. It's just, what's the alternative? A masochist, you know?
You have different feelings about millennials. I feel like you have emotions about it.
You say the word the way I say the word, even though I'm technically a millennial too.
I speak generational terms. I do, like, silent generation. I see these qualities, like, my parents are silent and I'm an Xer. mm-hmm. the boomers and their music and how much it means to me. And now I'm with millennials and my daughter's a millennial. So,
but it almost sounded like you are pleasantly surprised when you have a millennial student who is free of, you know, all of the sort of hang-ups that millennials can often be.
Oh, I find like we get territorial about our generation, and we do. You know,
we do. Actually,
and it's not like that. It shouldn't be. It should be fluid.
Yeah, but I just found out there's a term for our subset of millennials.
Oh, what is that?
It's Zennials.
Does that imply we're more Zen?
I think so.
Okay.
I think it's because we're on the cusp, so like we remember the time before social media, and like we grew up without cell phones and without Facebook and all those things. So we're a little bit chiller on that stuff.
I like it.
Yeah,
that works.
We tell ourselves we are.
Yeah.
But then you'll see us like tweeting and Instagramming this podcast.
Right. Right.
It's a fine line.
But I mean, I guess in that same vein, I understand your feelings about. I mean, streaming, it's just all very complicated, and for millennials and younger, you know, that's all that they know. But for you who came up in the 90s and for 20 years had a career where music was delivered in a certain way, and now it's delivered in a different way, I mean, what's your feeling? I mean,
it's very real for me because I'm an artist who collects, you know, and lives off of royalties. So that, on one hand, is like so felt by me or any artist, from the Eagles to the Indies, mm-hmm. our income is dramatically reduced by streaming. It's just taken away. It's so weird, and we are all floundering to find our way through a new music landscape. And we have to be smart and entrepreneurial and have many skill sets to navigate this. We have to sell tickets. We need to reach out. So I feel many things about it. On the other hand, I use Spotify. It's an amazing teaching and listening tool. So it's all things.
Right. Right.
So what's the deal with I Don't Want to Wait in Dawson's Creek on streaming? Dara mentioned this to me.
So yeah, what? I read that on now that Dawson's Creek, which I mean, huge fan.
Like Netflix or something.
You can
feel the emotion. The connectedness I feel with I Don't Want to Wait and Dawson's Creek is very real, and I think I speak for a lot of my generation when I say that. And then I read that on Netflix, it couldn't be used as a theme song because of just rights, and I mean, I guess that's a normal...
They didn't even ask me, so I don't know what they're going on about.
Huh. Really?
They just wanted to... Because I think the other music that they're using, they don't have to pay for.
Right.
Not a single penny.
Right, they paid for it outright.
Which is throwing us all under the bus. Mm. Every artist, mm-hmm. by anyone agreeing for that, you know. So there should be a certain level of humanity and rights for all artists that we should all band together and protect. But they didn't ask. So it's just happened. And there have been outcry and lots of complaints on Twitter, I get it all the time. It's always streaming in, but they don't change it.
Does it feel nice for you that it was so meaningful? Or
yeah.
I mean, of course, so much of your music is that, but when that's connected in such a lasting way, it must be nice.
I mean, it was a vehicle to bring it to another audience. The song, where it came from me, wasn't for Dawson's Creek.
Right, right.
It was for my grandparents. You know, I wrote it about my grandparents. And it was a hit on its own. Well before it was used for Dawson's Creek, but that was such a huge hit that it kind of left me in the dust, right? It was known as the Dawson's Creek theme song for better or
for worse. Paula Cole singing the Dawson's Creek. Everyone knew that it was your song
in my world.
But that's interesting. That's how it felt for you, was that here's this song I wrote about my grandparents and now it's about these teenagers.
I know. I mean, to listen to the lyrics today is shocking to me because I didn't pay that much attention to lyrics back then. I remember, I figured it was like a romantic song because it's a Dawson's Creek song.
Right.
And then you like actually pay attention to it. You're like, wait a minute. This was not written for Dawson's Creek, clearly.
And
it has an entirely other life.
Have taken on a whole new import.
Right? Yeah.
A whole new level of appreciation and love and acceptance. So I'm sad that it's not there. I think it's a much better song.
Definitely. Well, for the finale, I will just say, to give for the finale, they sprung for it. So it is there for the finale.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I don't watch it.
I was about to yell at everyone listening who's watching it for the first time on Netflix. Get like, to the you finale. Guys do not under, you're not emotionally prepared for each episode of that show if you have not heard that song at the top of the show.
I fully agree.
Right? Yes. It, like, gets you in the zone.
Oh, it's just so integral. That's why I couldn't not bring that up. It's just...
I care more about the song than I do about Dawson's Creek, by the way. I would not that actually talk about Dawson's Creek really... with this much enthusiasm.
Totally. What do I remember from that show? That's what I know.
So true. Right.
Well, thank you. Because I was sad about it, and that makes me feel better.
Oh, it's so everlasting. Yeah, no, it's and the people who grew up with it, it's forever.
Yeah. I remember at the City Winery show, I don't know, I couldn't hear what song they were calling out, but someone from the crowd asked you to sing an older song of yours, and you very politely demurred and said you just wanted to stick to what you were performing that night, but it made me wonder how you do feel about playing those older songs.
Oh, I'm fine with it. Yeah. I do it a lot.
Do you? Okay.
I do. Like hits that I play a lot. Yeah. I give that a lot. I've done it a lot.
Okay.
And I don't look at it as onerous at all. Like, it's so celebratory. Like, let's go into this party that is this song and let's jam this together, right? And it lifts the roof. It's fun. I'm great with it. But that was a specifically designed concert for, you know, to celebrate the music of John Lennon and Joni Mitchell.
that person was trying his luck.
Right. Totally.
I wanted to ask about, I love the question of, like, when you write these hits, do you ever know that it's a hit that you've written? So with either I Don't Want to Wait or Where Have All the Cowboys Gone, I'm curious, when you wrote that song, did you feel like, oh, this is it? Was it a magical feeling?
Oh, I had a funny feeling about Where Have All the Cowboys Gone. It just felt, and that was also the zeitgeist we were talking about, like my career. And I have felt that about other songs that didn't become hits, you know?
Yeah.
But there are so many moving constellations to a galaxy that is, how is a hit going to happen, right? And where are you in your career, and how's your management and your record label and the song? So... There were other songs that I thought, and I even said, this is my big hit song. You know? Not.
It's like falling in love with someone. People were like, I just knew when I met them, but like, how many times did they really think that to themselves? Right. Probably more than just someone.
That's funny. You recently re-recorded it, is that right? Or did you just do a new video? Okay, you re-recorded
it. And a video for Where Have All the Cowboys Gone,
directed by Melora Hardin.
Yeah.
Amazing.
So amazing.
I didn't know she was a director.
She's a badass director.
Awesome. You were going to say something
And else. She's my best friend, too.
Really?
Isn't that wonderful?
I love that. So,
and
huge fan. Melora
and I found her when I was living in L.A., and we were both pregnant together. And we became friends when we were massively pregnant.
Aww.
And we had our babies right around the same time. We both had girls. And we've just been really good friends ever since. And
that's awesome.
And then she got the gig as Jan on The Office. Yes. And then as Tammy. Mm-hmm.
We haven't talked about Transparent.
I know. Gotta come.
And now she's Jacqueline on The Bold Type.
Oh, yeah. That's cool. Right. I heard that's great.
It's great.
Yeah.
She's great.
So what was that decision to do that venture? Redo a new video?
I wanted to own the master for my hit song, and it meant I need to record it. That's one business thing aside. And I wanted to celebrate. Like, here we are at 20 years. It still feels funny, relevant. Like, there's nothing else like that song. Yeah. There never has been. Mm-hmm. And I just needed to put it out there again.
I love it.
That's awesome. All right, so 20 years after that, you also have a new album coming out.
Yeah.
Ballads.
Thank you.
It's so beautiful.
Thank you.
Gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous. I would imagine you have a catalog that is a million times the size of that in your head of songs that you would love to record. So how did you whittle it down to the ones that you went with?
I do have like so many songs that I love, and I've been waiting so long. That frustrated jazz singer in
right,
me.
Right, right, right.
So I was a slave driver, and I made the band. We recorded 31 songs in 5 days, and they were really good. And I had to whittle it down, and I thought, okay, well, this has to be a double album, which, again, is so counterculture, like in an age of singles, right? I'm just going against the grain. I'm doing vinyl, and it's going to be double vinyl.
Nice.
Yeah. It's out August 11th, and there'll be double vinyl. And it just, the sequencing was really hard. Which song flows great into the next? So there's some gems that were left off, but this was the right body. And I wanted to weave in songs that some might classify as Americana, uh-huh. and some might classify as jazz, but mm-hmm. I feel like they belong together. They're great American songs from the 30s to the 60s, primarily. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a nice diversity. It's songs made famous by men and women, like yeah. all different sorts of That's artists. Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's gorgeous.
And also I'm paying homage to my heroes.
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're going to be touring a bit?
Oh,
it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to be working.
Are you crisscrossing the country or what are you
oh,
doing?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
A lot.
Okay.
And That's touring, fine. Doing several shows where you're just doing this fire. Did I read that?
I've been doing that, and I probably will do a few more of those, but that's kind of ebbing and tucking into ballads now.
Cool.
Yeah, those are fun.
And the catalog is getting deep, so I have to kind of rotate some songs.
How fun.
Awesome. So August 11th, you said?
August 11th.
Awesome.
For ballads.
Great. All right, guys, check it out. It's gorgeous. We previewed it. Yeah.
Today.
Yeah. Paula, thank you so much.
Oh my
this
gosh.
A joy.
I hope
you
I didn't
on.
Swear too much.
I
really
I
let
think
loose.
I swear enough, actually. So
you know
time...
what's so funny? Just on one little anecdote.
Yeah, please.
I was singing jazz with Chris Bode at Madison Square Garden. He was opening Whoa. For Josh Groban, right? So it's all weird, right?
Very casual.
Good
and I was in the hallway in the back, and Josh comes over to me. He said, I saw you perform. You came to this arts camp that I was at in upstate Michigan. And they booked you because they thought you were so wholesome. And then you dropped so many F-bombs. We were so shocked.
That's awesome.
Oh, my God.
So that's a great story.
And I feel conscious about it. Like,
did that surprise you to hear about yourself?
It's spicy language. Yeah. I don't mean it with any malintent. Oh, it's just spice.
No, I'm sure it sounds beautiful coming out of your mouth. Yeah. I'm sure the kids weren't scarred at all. That's awesome. All right, Paula, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Lovely. Thank you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.